Hello, and welcome to the surgically reconstructed web edition of Behind the News for September 18, 2003. This is Doug Henwood. Unfortunately, because of a technical glitch, the first 10 minutes of our digital recording of the program were lost, and we had to scramble and find a tape substitute. The tape, unfortunately, is of rather low quality, muffled audio, and rather noisy as well. But it's only about the first 10 minutes of the program and my introduction and analysis of the economic news. The guests on tonight's show are Larry Siedentop, who is a professor of politics and international relations at Oxford University, talking about the European Union, its enlargement, the Swedish vote on the euro, and EU governance matters. And then about halfway into the program, Anatole Levin, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, will be talking about the state of affairs in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. Economist Dean Baker was supposed to call in to talk about his plan to eliminate restrictions on immigrants in the professional services, but he didn't call in, so we're going to have to wait till a later date for Dean Baker's idea. Unfortunately, the tape substitute for the digital version is also missing some material. The first minute or two, we join my commentary on the Federal Open Market Committee's policy setting meeting of earlier that week in medias res. I had been describing how the FOMC in earlier years used to offer no public explanation of what it had decided to do, and several years ago started releasing a brief commentary on the policy decision and its rationale, and now we'll join that in progress.
4 or 5 years ago, it started. It began releasing these short statements after its policy setting meetings. Some of them are kind of cryptic, but aficionados read them for clues to what they're thinking about and what they might be doing in the future. And this statement bore considerable resemblance to the last several statements in which they worried that the greater risk to the economy now was what they call an undesirably low or an undesirable decline in the rate of inflation. That's a euphemism for deflation, which is a euphemism for a rerun of the 1930s or something like that, or something like Japan's been going through for the last 10, 12 years. And nobody wants that, so the Fed has been on the guard against that. The innovation in this statement is that they're concerned about weakening in the labor market. They've been talking about labor market indicators were mixed, they said in the last statement, which came out in last month. But now they're saying that the labor market is weakening. And that's important because the Federal Reserve has some of the best economic analysis, intelligence, and forecasting people around. And so if they say that, one should take it very, very seriously. And they are institutionally disposed to be optimistic about the state of the U.S. economy. And so if they're saying the labor market is weakening, then that is important news. And this morning, speaking of the labor market, it was reported the weekly tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, and people who have just lost their jobs and are signing up for unemployment insurance for the first time. These numbers are released every Thursday and cover the previous week, so they're very accurate, very timely, and very important, both for their economic macroeconomic value, but also for their human value, what's happening with people and their jobs. And this initial claims figure fell by close to 30,000 this week, which is a welcome development. But still, it remains very high, and you could argue that the rise that we've seen in the last month or so in this indicator was very sharp, very sudden. So a little decline was in order. So this is welcome news, but certainly no sign of a trend reversal yet. The U.S. Job market is still quite weak and showing no signs of recovery. Another number we released every week, which is the ABC News Money Magazine Consumer Comfort Index, which is a weekly poll of thousands of households about their perception of their own finances and the state of the economy. That indicator, which has been pretty weak but flattish over the last month or so, fell three notches. It's now at minus 19, which is the lowest level it's been at since late July, early August. And it, like I said, it's been sort of meandering up and down from week to week with no clear trend, but this is not a happy development. We want to see that number picking up, the people turning more optimistic about the economy and also having brighter reports about the state of their own personal finances. And by the way, the number that reflects their own personal finances has fallen by 10 points over the last month or so. So the job market is not doing well. People's personal finances are not doing so well, and the economy's recovery does not seem to be getting down to the level of real people. On the other side of the economy, that is the capital goods side, the spending by businesses, which is the real motor of a capitalist economy, whether they invest and expand or not. One of the most important signals for that is the so-called book-to-bill ratio in the semiconductor industry. That is, measures how many new orders are coming in versus what's going out the door. And you want the orders coming in to be in an expansion. You want the orders coming in to exceed the orders being shipped. And so this so-called book-to-bill ratio is a pretty good indicator of what's going on with that. And of course, semiconductors are a crucial ingredient in today's high-tech industrial economy. This number still remains below one. That is, orders are not coming in at a strong enough pace. Their shipments, things that people ordered months ago, are going out the door, and fewer new orders are coming in. And this number has also been flat since about February. It did pick up or recover about the late part of last year a little bit, but has since stalled. And so there seems to be little sign of recovery in the book-to-bill ratio. And finally, a few words about the failure of the World Trade Organization ministerial talks in Cancun earlier this over the weekend. I don't know. I think what I have to say is probably not the kind of thing you've been hearing from similar sources. So let me just say a few words about that. First of all, despite a lot of rhetoric to the contrary, the World Trade Organization has never been a tool of the U.S. and other rich countries. In fact, they've generally starved it for resources. As the Columbia professor Jagdish Bhagwati likes to point out, the WTO's entire budget is less than the IMF's travel budget alone. The problem for the rich countries is that the WTO is structured according very much like the General Assembly of the United Nations, one country, one vote. The U.S. much prefers structures like the Security Council, where it has a veto, or within the IMF, where it has 18% of the total vote and an effective veto as well. And so the WTO is a little too democratic for the taste of the United States, and so it's not simply a tool of rich countries to push poor countries around. And that's part of the reason why the talks collapsed. And conceptually, don't we want some kind of body to regulate international trade? I think that a lot of people have been welcoming the collapse of the World Trade Organization, but that would quite possibly leave the United States free to throw its weight around even more than it does. It would be without some kind of multilateral body, it would leave the United States to negotiate trade deals with one country at a time, and so that would be very unequal structure. Separate deals negotiated with weaker countries who have no opportunity to band together as the so-called group of 21 countries did in Cancun to stop the talks. So this would give the Bush administration yet another outlet for its unilateralist lusts. And the suicide of the Korean farmer Lee Kyung-hae is being taken by many people as part of the same struggle as the so-called group of 21 countries that stood up to the U.S. and the European Union that led to the stalemate that scuppered the talks. That's about the opposite of the truth. Farmer Lee killed himself in defense of just the kind of agricultural protectionism that the group of 21 countries led by Brazil and India, it's just the kind of thing they were fighting against. So there's no common interest there, although some people seem to have found one. Progressives also need to think through the kind of trade regime they'd really like to see. I think a lot of us are too quick to support protectionist measures that could injure workers in poorer countries and too quick to resort to language defending national sovereignty when we should really be looking for a more egalitarian and cooperative world. And is it really our birthright that Americans should forever enjoy $40,000 incomes and Chinese and Indians $300 incomes? Farmer Lee's brand of farming produces low-quality crops at very high costs and can only survive with extensive government support. Is the production of expensive and inferior food really a progressive goal? Let's think a little bit more seriously about this stuff, please. And as a matter of empirical fact, there is no race to the bottom because of international trade, as you frequently hear. U.S. wages are higher now than they were the day that NAFTA took effect. Wages are rising in most of Asia and in much of Western Europe. The region with the greatest economic problems in the world is Africa, and it is largely excluded from global trade and capital flows. As the British economist Joan Robinson once said, under capitalism, the only thing worse than being exploited is not being exploited at all. And so let's turn to an interview I recorded earlier today with Larry Siedentop, who is a professor of politics at Oxford University, and talking about the state of affairs within the European Union. Setting up this interview, just a couple of facts. The Swedes voted over the weekend not to join the common currency, the euro, and to keep their own currency instead. And a lot of the reasoning behind that was they were afraid that joining the euro would threaten their welfare state, because of the European Union's strict budget criteria. And the Estonia, however, voted to join the European Union at the same time over the same weekend. And in this interview, I make reference to a stability pact, which is an agreement of the Euro countries that they will keep their budget deficits very small, and they will balance their budgets. And a number of large countries, France, Germany, and Italy, among them, are violating the stability pact and running large deficits and don't seem to be doing anything about it. So I asked Siedentop what he thought of that. And also, there is an enlargement of the European Union in the works. Union now has 15 members. It's going to get 10 more over the next year or so. These are Cyprus, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, Poland, the Slovak Republic, and Slovenia. So that's the enlargement that I referred to in the following interview. And here's Larry Siedentop.
What are we to make of the almost simultaneously rejection of the euro by Sweden and the embrace of the EU by Estonian voters? Is this is there a contradiction here, or can you find a common message?
Well, I think on the surface it's a contradiction, but if you dig it all deep, it is pretty much a common message. The Estonians are above all anxious to secure their own independence, and for that reason the first step is to get the protection of NATO and the European Union. And then having taken that, I think their mood will change, as indeed the mood of nearly all the new member countries will do once all the formalities of joining the European Union are completed. Because going around Eastern Europe and talking to these people in the last year or two, I've been very struck by their determination to defend their national interests. I mean, in some ways, you know, they have a very old-fashioned approach to national interests, one which has been slightly passé in Western Europe since 1945, and I think that attitude, which people attribute to Sweden as a result of its rejection of the euro, is going to become perhaps the dominant one in the European Union, and it's going to gradually, perhaps even not so gradually, undermine the Franco-German hegemony. Now, you know, I suppose you could say that Britain, together with now Spain especially, are the sort of natural leaders of that alternative view of the European Union as more like a confederation than a tight federation.
How would Estonia be defending its national interest by joining the European Union? Doesn't that require a certain sacrifice of national interest in favor of a collective identity?
Well, it just requires some slight sacrifice of national interest, but if you've been under Soviet occupation for decades, I think the sacrifice looks rather slight.
We're also seeing within the EU a number of important countries breaking the Stability and Growth Pact with very large budget deficits. How much of a threat to the union and the currency does this represent, or is this just a path of evolution towards a new kind of EU?
I think it may well be the latter. I mean, I think it doesn't pose any immediate threat to the Euro project itself, but I think the reverberations for the governance of the European Union are going to be very important, because already many of the smaller countries are uneasy about some of the changes being proposed in Giscard d'Estaing's constitution for the European Union, changes which they see, changes in voting rights, for instance, in the Council of Ministers, which they see as increasing the clout of the large states and weakening that of the smaller states. So that not only the applicant countries, but even the existing members of the European Union, the smaller countries who are members of the Euro Club, look askance at what they see as a double standard. That is, that France and Germany can get away with things which, let's say, Portugal, Austria, the Netherlands might not be able to get away with. And that perception will be fairly easily joined to, I think, this rather nationalist mood in the new member states, and will, as I said, I think, gradually undermine the Franco-German hegemony in the European Union.
Is it possible for Sweden and maybe some other similarly situated countries to be kind of half in and half out?
Well, that's the position. Many people would say Britain has been in since it joined the European Union. It's perfectly right. The original conception was of a free trade area in the form of a single market, and there are still many, and what one might call the peripheral countries, the countries bordering the Atlantic, or islands like Britain and Ireland, who continue to see it primarily as an economic arrangement. The the greater political project, the project for a tighter, more integrated Europe, which might, in certain respects, according to the French and Germans, stand up to the United States more effectively and disperse power in the world. That project has never been so close, I think, to the hearts of what I call these peripheral countries.
Yeah, so what are the prospects now for an attempt by the EU to develop a common political, military, diplomatic strategy? Is this and offer some kind of counterweight to the United States? Is that looking a little cloudier now?
Well, obviously the quarrel between Spain and Britain on the one hand, Germany and France on the other, over in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, has certainly, let's say, put it politely, postponed the achievement of anything like a common foreign or military policy. And there's great reluctance still in some of these ancient nation states to cede what are traditionally some of the most important spheres of national sovereignty. I think that has that prospect is delayed, maybe even long delayed.
And what does the Swedish vote do to prospects of Britain joining the Euro?
Well, I think, I didn't think there was going to be a referendum even before the Swedish vote, and now it's, I think, almost completely out of the question. I see no likelihood of Britain joining the Euro in this decade, let's say. Beyond that, well, depends what happens to the Eurozone. But Giscard and his constitution, which is a, you know, a new treaty which is supposed to replace all previous treaties. Without indulging in conspiracy theory, it certainly, in a sense, puts Britain on the spot. Because, first of all, it's going to create enormous pressure on the Blair government to hold something like a referendum, since many people deem this to be a treaty of fundamental, that is, constitutional importance. And, of course, given public opinion in Britain, it would be a hard slog for any government to win such a referendum. It would be rather tragic if Britain were to sort of be had dissociated or have dissociated from the European Union at this point when, as I've said, in many ways, I think the current is now flowing in Britain's direction with enlargement.
Yeah, and finally, with the Union about to experience a large increase in its numbers numbers of members over the next coming years, how are they going to govern the thing? Is this going to become just too large and unwieldy and contradictory a structure?
Well, that's a good question, and I think the answer is no one knows. I mean, the attempt, of course, of the Giscard Convention on the future of Europe was to tie everything up before the formalities of enlargement were completed. But my hunch is that the dynamics of an enlarged community are going to prove more important than whatever the formal agreements reached about a constitution for Europe are.
And that was interview with Larry Seedentop, I recorded earlier today. Larry Seedentop, professor of politics at Oxford University. And let's take a little musical break and come back and see who materializes. From the Gang of Four, Capital, It Fails Us Now, from about the late 1970s. And I think, need to take a break because we've had a little reshuffling of the schedule, and we need to let Anatole Levin prepare himself for the interview because... are we ready to go? Oh, okay. So we do not need to take a break after all. We have now Anatole Levin on the line. Anatole Levin is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and a frequent guest here. And we've pressed him into service once again because the ongoing melodrama in Iraq keeps getting messier and messier, more melodramatic with each passing day. And I think in the run-up to the war, he said very memorably that the Bush administration was staffed by a bunch of people who weren't fit to run a kebab stand in Baghdad, much less run the whole country, and certainly time has proved the prescience of that remark. Welcome to WBI, Anatole Levin.
Thank you.
So, last time I asked you, are things as bad as you expected? And I guess I have to ask you that again. Are any surprises in the evolution of events in Iraq over recent weeks?
I wouldn't say so, no. I mean, I'm surprised they haven't got Saddam himself yet, on the assumption that he's still in the country. I mean, given the amount of effort and the amount of money that's spent, I would have expected them at least to find him. So that's a surprise. Beyond that, no, not really, I'm afraid. I think all this is heading in a quite predictable direction.
Well, what's your diagnosis of who's responsible for the attacks on the U.S. troops, the attacks on the infrastructure? Is Donald Rumsfeld right that it's just a bunch of a dwindling band of dead enders, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, if one's read some of the more detailed newspaper reports, it's clear that, on the one hand, the attacks are being certainly funded and to a very great extent carried out and organized by the old Ba'ath Party, its members, and by former members of the Iraqi military. It would seem, though, that they're beginning to recruit considerable numbers of new volunteers from members of the Sunni Arab population, in part, of course, from people whose families have suffered in some way directly from the war. And then again, of course, because the Sunni Arabs have seen their status, their power within Iraq greatly diminished as a result of the overthrow of the Ba'ath, just as the Pashtuns in Afghanistan saw their power greatly diminished by the overthrow of the Taliban. So there's a common motive at stake. And then a really sinister development, of course, is the way in which Iraq is now beginning to suck in Islamist militants and terrorists, Al-Qaeda and its allies from all over the Muslim world. This, of course, is something that happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan and the Russians in Chechnya. It's also happened in Kashmir to the Indians and, to an extent, the Israelis in Palestine. You get into that conflict and you then, of course, become a target for all the resentments and all the hatreds of the entire region.
What about the Iraqi population itself? How deeply religious are the various peoples of Iraq, or is a lot of this an import of both people and ideologies from abroad?
Well, when it comes to Islamist terrorism, one's talking here about the Sunni Arab population, which is less than a quarter of the whole population of Iraq. The Shiites, of course, are bitterly hostile to this Sunni extremism because the Shiites have suffered very badly in the past, you know, not just obviously from the Ba'ath regime, but over the centuries from attack by Sunni extremists as well, and one sees that continuing in Pakistan. One of the possible perpetrators of the terrible attack on the mosque a few weeks ago in Najaf, you know, it could well have been a Sunni extremist group. So far, it's difficult to say, though, just how much of a presence they've established among the Sunnis. Among the Shias, of course, religious groups are very important. So far, most of them are willing, if not to work with, at least to tolerate the American presence. But, of course, they're doing so in the expectation that when elections are finally held and power is handed to the Iraqis, that they will dominate Iraq. Well, if America is determined to prevent Shia religious parties taking over, well, then there's another very serious problem beginning to loom up.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, who is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. My name is Doug Henwood. The program Behind the News, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. What about the Governing Council the U.S. put together several months ago? Is anything coming of that? Does that have any credibility or any power, or does it serve as any way as a nucleus of a meaningful government in the future?
I think it could conceivably serve as the nucleus of a future government. It's a long way from that at present. from everything that one could gather. And of course, you know, as we know from the precedent of Vietnam and many other precedents around the world, it's very, very difficult to give real power to an institution of that kind when you're fighting a brutal guerrilla war at the same time. Because clearly, you know, at the moment, the American army is basically running the show because it is fighting a war. And as long as that goes on, unless one can create or accept Iraqi forces to take over from America, no authority created in Iraq is going to, I think, be seen by most Iraqis to have, you know, real prestige or control.
When the Bush administration frequently claims that despite all the headlines, things are actually getting better in Iraq and they're making progress, do they have any basis for saying that, or is this just more of their creative relation with truth?
It seems that trade, the retail trade, is picking up again. That at least quite a number of people are once again able to buy things, including consumer goods. Of course, money is coming into the country from the U.S. to pay at least a considerable number of salaries. So I think, you know, it would be wrong to say that things are completely black. I mean, we're not talking here about, you know, something on the level of Liberia, say. But equally, it would seem that the perception of the great majority of Iraqis, you know, is still that they're considerably worse off than they were, well, last year, that services are still in a very bad shape. Many areas are still facing acute shortages of water, electricity, and the health situation is very bad, once again, even by comparison with last year, as is, of course, the crime situation. So, you know, although perhaps things are not quite as bad as some critics have painted them, and they could certainly be a great deal worse, in the end, it's not a question of what we think, or even objectively thinking, or objectively speaking, what the situation is. It's a question of Iraqi perceptions. And those would appear still, in general, to be pretty bad.
Any idea of why the United States is having such a terrible time getting the water and the electricity running again? Is this sheer incompetence? Or I've heard some conspiratorial types say that, you know, the United States really doesn't want Iraq to run again. They want to keep it in a state of chaos and disorder.
No, I don't think that's correct. I think that the Bush administration has a tremendous amount just in U.S. domestic political terms, riding on making a success of Iraq. I think it's just, you know, I mean, this is a big country of 25 million people with an infrastructure which was already pretty run down as a result of 10 years of sanctions and so on, and which is now also, which then suffered a terrible wave of looting and sabotage. And the existing state structures which managed all this to a very considerable extent either dissolved themselves or were dissolved by the U.S. when it came in as part of the, in my view, ill-thought-out de-Ba'athification process. And so I think it's just, you know, it's a terrible mess. And also, of course, simply the fact that the U.S. didn't draw up a proper detailed plan for what to do after the war, the fact that the U.S. authority is critically short of Arabic speakers, the fact that because of security concerns, you know, you don't have U.S. officials sitting out in most of these places, you know, trying to manage things and talking to the local population and solving problems because they're, you know, obviously afraid of being killed, and the fact that you know, you need a really integrated, well-planned strategy of international procurement above all from Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union, which provided a lot of this infrastructure in the first place. Well, there, I think one can say that there was a measure of active culpability on the part of the Bush administration, because, of course, the idea was, in many circles, that nobody else was going to have a look at these contracts, that America was going to rebuild the whole country. Well, I hope that that is now being dropped, but it hasn't been replaced by, you know, what I think is necessary, which is, you know, really to go out and see if some of these Russian factories and others, Ukrainians, who produce this stuff are still operating, and if they are, to get them operating again.
Some of my reflexively anti-imperialist friends think that the United States should just up and leave and let Iraqis sort things out. What would happen, do you think, if that unlikely event were to come to pass?
Well, I should say that I'm against that. I mean, I strongly opposed going into Iraq. But I do think that, you know, once you've done that, you do have you've assumed a responsibility. And I think it would be grossly irresponsible simply to cut and run. I think that if the U.S. did that, there would very soon be appalling bloodshed between the Ba'ath forces, with considerable backing, I think, from large sections of the Sunni population, and Shia militias in the south, and indeed Kurds in the north. I think there would be terrible ethnic trouble between Kurds in the north and local Turkmen and Arabs. I mean, we've seen some of that so far, but it could get much, much worse. And if that happened, there would be a very grave risk of Turkey being sucked in to attack the Kurds and try to crush Kurdish nationalism. So, no, I mean, I think there would be every chance of a truly disastrous situation. That said, I think that, you know, there is a strong case to be made for the U.S. Handing over ultimate political authority to the UN, if only for the sake of legitimacy, and recognizing that, you know, the U.S. is not going to get everything that it wants in Iraq. In particular, I think, given everything that we've seen so far, it has to be recognized that Shia religious parties, you know, do just have so much public support and a really striking degree of organization, given the way in which they were repressed by the Ba'ath. I mean, that actually was a surprise to me. You asked what had surprised me, that these Shia groups were still so strong. And inevitably, they're going to play, you know, a very, very important, even leading role in the Iraq of the future. And, you know, the idea, which is still current, that this is not permissible, you know, that we're determined to have a secular Iraq, I mean, that's either moonshine or extremely dangerous.
And what about the prospects for the U.S. handing things over to the U.N.? Does the Bush administration show any interest in that? Is it willing to make the kinds of compromises necessary for that to happen? And how receptive are the other major players to that kind of handover?
Well, that's one big question, of course. My own feeling is that sooner or later, Iraq is going to become such an embarrassment to the Bush administration domestically, that it is going to become just desperate to shuffle the problem off onto somebody else, and that whatever line it's taking now on the subject of the UN will in fact change as, you know, the domestic political repercussions of this get more and more evident. But then, of course, the question becomes, does the UN want it, actually? You know, or more importantly, would the UN be able to sort the situation out? And will other countries provide serious numbers of peacekeeping forces for Iraq? And there, you know, obviously one has to be pretty skeptical, and particularly since the international community, to put it mildly, didn't ask America to go in there. So the entire Iraqi situation, if you like, has no international legitimacy. And I think there will be very great reluctance in most countries around the world to make serious sacrifices to sort out a mess which is essentially seen as one of America's making, particularly if it's a question of doing that in order to try to save the Bush administration domestically, because to be quite blunt, I don't think many countries or many governments around the world are particularly interested in saving the Bush administration in next year's elections. There's a widespread feeling that almost anything would be better, except possibly Mr. Lieberman.
I can't say I disagree with that. I started reading Thomas Friedman's column this morning and couldn't get past the third paragraph or so, but I think he said something to the effect that France is now our enemy because it wants the U.S. to fail in Iraq. What do you think of that diagnosis and also Friedman saying that?
Well, does France want the U.S. to fail completely? Look, a great many governments, including, I think, very, very privately and secretly, the British government, they're not obviously happy about the situation in Iraq. They are happy that the situation in Iraq has led to a new sobriety in the Bush administration. I mean, the nightmare of Britain, but so many other countries as well, was that the neocon agenda would triumph as a result of an easy victory in Iraq, and that America would go on, maybe to attack Iran, or at least to put very heavy pressure on Iran. And so I think they do welcome the fact that these ambitions have now been reined in, and that further military action is now highly unlikely, unless, of course, God forbid, America is attacked again. But defining France as an enemy, this, I think, is very, very dangerous, because it's part of this, I think, fatal tendency here in some quarters to classify countries. You know, you're with us or you're against us. It's black or it's white. I mean, clearly France is not an enemy in the sense that the old Soviet Union was. It's not ideologically opposed to the entire American system, nor indeed is it opposed to what I still take to be America's vital interest today, which is the struggle against Al-Qaeda, which France sees very much as its interest to fight against Islamist terrorism. After all, it's been doing so itself for years, both on the soil of France itself and in Algeria and elsewhere. And intelligence cooperation between France and America, from what I gather, has continued very strongly in recent months, quite unaffected by what's happened in Iraq. So I would say that this is very harmful language. And in that connection, and in the connection of, you know, this whole business, you're with us or you're against us, I think that what we have to learn, and I think you can see this now in U.S. relations with Russia and a number of other countries, is that we're now entering an age of diplomatic maneuver and openness in which old allies can't be relied on. We've seen that Turkey can't be relied on, for example, and that basically you have to make new deals according to every new situation.
Oh, and what's the mood like in Washington? Did people there, were they shocked by the turn of events in Iraq? And now you mentioned the new sobriety. Are they trying to reflect on what led them to their moment of drunkenness, or are they just sort of wandering around confused?
Well, I think people are very bad at least admitting publicly that they made a mistake, and especially, of course, administrations. It's too much to ask, but individuals as well. But I think if you read, the columnists, or you listen to the speech makers, and you contrast the kind of noises that they were making in the months leading to the Iraq War, the kind of noises about transforming the Middle East, about how Americans were going to be greeted as liberators, about how, any country which stood up to America over Iraq was, you know, evil and wicked and so forth. The language has changed tremendously, I find, in most quarters. Not everywhere, as Friedman's latest remark shows. But nonetheless, I find a great deal less, you know, gung-ho arrogance and ambition, simply because, you know, Iraq is such a mess.
But that was the core of the foreign policy of the Bush administration and, you know, the whole PNAC gang. Now, do they have a foreign policy?
Well, I think Colin Powell does have a foreign policy, yes. And I think it's, you know, it's a pragmatic one. And it's reflected, you know, not just now in the new approaches to the UN, but in a strategy over North Korea, in terms of trying to work through China, in terms of trying to put together regional coalitions and so forth, which is totally different from the rhetoric, you know, we were hearing about North Korea from people like Bolton, or, you know, in the context of the Axis of Evil speech. So I think Powell does have an international strategy. The problem is, of course, that so much damage has already been done by previous Bush administration actions. And the mess in Iraq, the imbroglio in Iraq, is so deep and possibly insoluble that rather than a strategy, at least as far as Iraq is concerned, it's coming to look more like crisis management on the hoof.
Let's, in the few minutes left over, let's go to last year's crisis, Afghanistan. What do things look like there? It sort of disappeared from the front pages.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the key reasons for opposing the Iraq war was precisely because of the enormous unsolved problems in Afghanistan and the way, of course, that these hook up with potentially even greater problems in neighboring Pakistan. And, of course, the fact that the guy who planned 9/11, whose organization carried it out, is still alive, you know, sitting out there and laughing at us, damn it. And recent developments in Afghanistan tend to suggest that he has quite a lot to laugh about. Well, on top, of course, of the developing situation in Iraq. It's clear that Afghanistan is not on anything remotely like the road, the path that was mapped out 2 years ago when the Taliban fell. And it's not just a question of putting in more U.S. money. It's a question of developing, you know, an entirely new strategy for the region, including Afghanistan, and being willing to stick around for the generation, perhaps, which is necessary to give this any chance of success.
I've seen reports that the Taliban are coming back, there's really no government, national government to speak of outside of the capital region. Is this true?
Yes, I think that's entirely true, except that there isn't really a government as such, even in the capital region. It's protected by international peacekeepers and U.S. air power. It's completely divided amongst itself. It's not really a government. It's a kind of national negotiating committee of the different warlords and ethnic groups. And, of course, it doesn't have a serious army of its own. So, that's not to say that there isn't a great deal that we can do in Afghanistan, even without a functioning central government. But then we've got to do it ourselves. And to some extent, that is beginning, for example, with the U.S. Military's reconstruction of parts of the road system. But we're going to have to do a lot more if we're going to have any chance of showing ordinary Afghans that their lives have got better as a result of the Taliban's fall.
And it's going to take serious money to do that, and with Iraq claiming, you know, $75 billion already and another $87 to come, where is this money going to come from?
Well, I mean, since the Europeans did support the war in Afghanistan, I think that the U.S. has, you know, a completely legitimate argument to ask more from the international community. But it's not just a question of raising the money. The spending of this money in Afghanistan has to be secured. If it's not possible to raise reliable Afghan troops to do this, for a whole set of reasons, then the U.S. is going to have more of a military presence on the ground. Well, as we know, you know, the U.S. is now facing appalling shortages of manpower as a result of the Iraq war. So where are the troops going to come from?
Well, it looks like maybe the imperial ambitions of the Bush administration may be the last of the American bubbles to burst. All right, well, thanks for joining us, Anatol Lieben.
Thank you.
Anatol Lieben is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and he joined us a little early and stayed a little longer than we'd initially planned, so thanks to him for doing so. And that's it for me, Doug Henman. I'm going to go out a little early because Dean Baker stood us up. And let's go out with this little bit of music and... yes, reveals me as yet another alienated urban intellectual with a soft spot for Johnny Cash. So, if that's the case, sue me. Johnny Cash, Bird on a Wire.
Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. Like a fish on a hook, like a knife in some old-fashioned book, I have saved all my ribbons for thee. And if I have been unkind, I just hope you we'll let it go by. And if I have been untrue, I hope you know it was never to you. Like a baby stillborn, like a beast with his horn, I have torn everyone who reached out to me. But I swear by the song and by all that I have done wrong, I'll make it all up to thee. I saw a young man leaning on his wooden crutch. He called out to me, "Don't ask for so much." And a young woman leaning in her darkened door, she cried out to me, "Why not ask for more?" Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.